Welcome to this 19-part series of Business Podcasts by David Maister, exploring the key principles and practices found in his new book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker.
Hello, I'm David Maister. In this series of podcasts, I'm proud to present a special 19-part series of the audiobook version of my new book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker. If you're interested in purchasing a copy of the book in hardback, it is now available from both Amazon.com and at my website at davidmaister.com/store. Chapter 2. Strategy means saying no. I was helping a prominent global company explore the strategy of achieving high levels of client or customer service. We were discussing ways of investing resources and redesigning processes to accomplish this goal. But the longer the discussion continued, the more uncomfortable some members of the organization became. But what about the clients or customers who don't want all this high-touch contact, they asked me. What are we supposed to do with them? Won't we scare away a significant portion of our current customer base by doing things they don't want? Yes, you will, I replied. A strategy is not just choosing a target market, but it's actually about designing an operation that will consistently deliver the superior client benefits that you claim to provide and that is wanted by that segment. However, each decision you make to be more effective at delivering the preferences of those you target will inevitably, unavoidably, make you less attractive to clients or customers or market segments that look for other benefits. But consider the alternative, I continued. Your market appeal could be, tell us what you want us to do for you and we'll do that. We'll do something different for other people tomorrow. You may get by with this approach, but you'll be unlikely to achieve a competitive differentiation or a reputation, except as people who, as long as they are getting paid, will do anything for anyone, which is not an image I think you want to have. Finally, someone said out loud what was on everybody's mind. But do we have the courage to turn away business? Do we really have the confidence to tell paying customers that we are not right for them? My answer? Not only should you do that, but the only way you can achieve any strategic distinction is to do that. Strategy is deciding whose business you're going to turn away. One of the first lessons I was taught at the Harvard Business School in the 1970s was Wickham Skinner's principle of the focus factory. No operation, Professor Skinner pointed out, can be good at everything simultaneously. An operation designed to provide the highest quality is unlikely to be the one that achieves the lowest cost, and the one that can respond to a wide variety of customized requests will be unlikely to provide fast response and turnaround. Any business that tried to deliver all four virtues of quality, cost, variety, and speed would be doomed to failure. This is not just an operational point, but a marketing one. To be differentiated in the eyes of the marketplace, you have to be known for something in particular. It's not enough just to be known. That's name awareness, which is not the same thing as being seen as differentiated. And you can't have a reputation for being something specific if you only do it occasionally for some people. The very essence of having a strategy is being selective about choosing the criteria on which you wish to compete, and then being creative and disciplined in designing an operation that is finely tuned to deliver those particular virtues better than anyone else. Consider McDonald's. For any customer that truly places a premium on low cost and speed, McDonald's is hard to beat because it has been optimized around a clear market positioning. However, if someone were to walk into McDonald's and say, "I feel like having a curry today," the service provider would not reply, "Oh, sure, that will increase our revenues. Let me shut down the grill and make you one." Instead, the reply, except perhaps in India, would be, "I'm sorry, but we are not designed to meet every possible need. Perhaps I can help you find someone nearby that can give you what you want." As companies keep discovering to their cost, it is certain business decay if you try to please all possible market segments. The broader the group of clients to which you try to appeal, or the wider the range of service you try to provide, the less customized your operation can be to each segment within that group. If you never say no, you will be just one more undifferentiated company trying to do a little bit of everything. And as Professor Skinner pointed out, you must almost certainly be superb at none of them. As obvious as this all may seem, translating it into reality can be very difficult. The practical reality of most businesses is that they find it very difficult to say no to a revenue-generating opportunity. As Dick Tyler, the managing senior officer of UK law company Cameron McKenna, says, "The hardest thing in the world for most professionals is to turn work away. It offends our desperate desire to be liked by everyone and plays to the insecurity that afflicts even the best of us. The moment we aren't worked off our feet, we worry that we'll never work again." The situation has been made worse by many companies' explicit, if misguided, efforts to transform themselves into one-stop shopping, with extensive efforts at cross-selling additional services to clients or customers. The hunger for volume and the use of managerial scorecards that emphasize volume has meant that many individuals and companies are often uncomfortable with or even shocked by the notion that to achieve a distinctive strategy, they will need to turn away work that a major competitor might reasonably want to serve. I've experienced the same dilemma. When I first left my academic post at the Harvard Business School and launched my consulting business, I had this dream, more a hope at that stage, that I could distinguish myself from the general mainstream of management consultants by focusing on a particular sector, professional service companies. However, one of the first phone calls I received was from a car manufacturer who was familiar with some of the work I had done while I was still a teacher in the general area of customer service. "How would I like," they asked, "to provide training in retail customer service to their automobile dealers?" You can see the problem. Did I want the cash? You bet. I was just starting out. But if I spent my time doing generic customer service training for car dealers, I wasn't going to make myself special as a consultant. I'd be one more competent guy doing what any number of other people could do. I had to make a choice. Did I believe in my own declared strategy? And did I have the courage to spend my time making it reality? Or was I sufficiently insecure that I could be tempted away from my chosen strategy by the promise of cash? I'm not saying the choice was easy, and I'm not saying that I was or am a better or more noble person than anyone else, just because I turned the opportunity down and chose to pursue my differentiation strategy. I am saying that facing such decisions is the very essence of what having a strategy is all about. If you don't have the courage, you will never achieve a differentiated strategy. And of course, courage is one of the scarcest commodities there is. That's why it's a significant source, maybe even the sole source, of competitive advantage. Even when people acknowledge all of this, they still come up with many reasons why they think it is unwise or even forbidden to say no. Many people worry that it would be perceived as being a bad service provider if they were to decline to serve an existing client or customer on a new need. They think that it would be taken amiss if they said, "We don't want to serve you in that additional area." This, however, misses the point. What you say to the client or customer is not, "We don't want your additional work," but you say something like, "We're not your best choice for that new need. You may be better served to go to a specialist who can focus on providing the particular benefit you seek." Done this way, you're likely to cement your relationship with that client, not hurt it, because you will have demonstrated your trustworthiness and your willingness to place the client's interests ahead of your own short-term gain. If you really believe in the power of relationships, having a client that trusts you must be of greater economic value to you than having a group of clients or customers who are always suspicious of your motives. Still, many people are unconvinced. Yes, they observe, it may be more noble and a good way to earn trust, but doesn't it just allow a competitor to get his nose inside the tent? Once you let a competitor start serving your client or customer, don't you run the risk that that competitor steals your relationship? Shouldn't you work to keep your competitors out of dealing with your clients or customers? The first answer to this is that even if you tried to pull it off, it is impossible to keep your client or customer away from all other providers. The hope that you can keep everyone else away is delusional. Secondly, the real-world truth is that you keep clients or customers loyal to you by serving them superbly, earning their trust, and making them want to have a relationship with you above all others. A person or company would appear very insecure and not very impressive if they were seen to worry about the client talking to anyone else. It would actually destroy trust and increase the chances that they would want to go somewhere else. Strong, self-confident businesses who know who they are do not try to do everything for their client. Ask the world's most profitable law firm, Wachtell Lipton, to do a broad range of your legal work, and they will patiently explain that they should only be hired when you truly require the world's experts in their chosen fields. The same is true of top consulting companies like McKinsey. Almost certainly in the course of their strategy work, they will uncover the need for, say, training or market research. Would they attempt to offer standalone training and focus group services merely to keep other management consulting companies away? Highly unlikely. Ah, yes, people say, it's all very well to cite examples like that, but those are established, successful companies. They can afford to say no, we can't. There's a chicken and an egg problem here. If you can't afford to say no until you're successful and distinguished, then you'll never be successful and distinguished. Everyone has an excuse why they cannot make the hard choices and why they need a special exemption. Small companies claim they should be excused because they're not yet established. Large companies, on the other hand, bemoan the fact that they have a big factory of people on the payroll that they have to keep busy. Young people claim they cannot afford to take risks and be selective because they have student loans and are too junior to decline opportunities. Senior people point to their mortgage obligations, the need to pay the college fees for their kids, and so on. Everyone's got a reason why it's especially hard for them to be strategic and to say no. And most of them are excuses, not reasons. It reflects a lack of courage and a risk aversion. Perhaps the single biggest problem in achieving the implementation of a strategy is the difficulty of ensuring that everyone in the organization understands what the strategy is and that top management really wants everyone else to follow it. In the global meeting that I described at the beginning of this article, someone eventually asked, how can the manager of this company ask me to achieve a distinctive market positioning while simultaneously pressuring me to meet budget numbers? Given a choice, and there is one, what do they really want me to do? If the strategy is to become real, then the answer from management must be, we want both current cash and the benefits of sticking to a strategy. But if it ever comes to a choice, we want you to place execution of our strategy ahead of meeting the budget. Following this rule and pulling off our strategy will make more money, not less. This message is scarce. The CEO's message needs to be as unambiguous as Warren Buffett's description to a U.S. Senate subcommittee of his managerial philosophy. Make an honest mistake and I will be understanding, but lose the reputation of the enterprise and I will be ruthless. Needless to say, few top managers convince their people that this is what they truly want. As a result, strategies go unimplemented. It is incredibly hard, even for sincere leaders, to get their colleagues and subordinates to believe that they have changed and that they will manage to new standards, i.e. have a new strategy. People almost never believe this. They just don't accept that there has been a conversion on the road to Damascus. They never believe there truly is a new religion in place. They always worry that their leaders will, when they are tested with a trade-off, go back to managing the way they did during the prior 5, 10, or 15 years. Until they have hard evidence to the contrary, they don't think that management has the ability to say no to temptation. Managers must work constantly to act as a countervailing force to powerful financial reporting systems, which almost inevitably fail to make a distinction between strategy and volume. Revenues and profits that are obtained by acting in ways consistent with the strategy versus those that were obtained in ways that involve compromises of the standards implicit in the strategy. First, it is necessary to create new scorecards built into the company's regular reporting systems that can distinguish between on-strategy work and off-strategy work. In one company, as a piece of special analysis, it was discovered that 65% of their business came from only 100 of their 4,000 total clients, and that most of the remainder were unprofitable. The realization soon dawned that such analyses are not very helpful if they're only done periodically and in retrospect. Given the will, it was not too difficult to build this analysis into the company's regular monitoring and managing approaches, making the company's regular reviews of its result more strategic. As I discussed in Measuring Your Marketing Success, a chapter in my book True Professionalism, there are also ways to monitor which revenue streams are building your asset, i.e. helping you strategically, and which ones are milking your asset, good for the bottom line but not moving you forward. Next, a CEO or managing senior officer will need to ask what it is that he or she can do personally that will give dramatic evidence that top management is serious about adhering to the strategy in spite of short-term temptations. It's necessary for top management to do something, not just say something, that is both sufficiently dramatic and sufficiently different from the way that management has behaved in the past so that the people in the organization start to discuss the story of what they've done and pass it on to others. The challenge is to figure out what the CEO or others in top management could do that would be dramatic enough and a break with the past, but would also be seen as credible and not just window dressing. The answer will depend on the specific company situation, but I often suggest that CEOs and managing officers ask their people the question directly. What could I do that would convince you that I was serious about sticking to our new strategy and enforcing the standards that flow from it? It is perhaps sad to report this, but since people are always skeptical that specific individuals have changed, the most dramatic evidence that things have changed is when new people are put in managerial roles and in key positions of influence. As one of my clients said, the only way to change people is to change people. This concludes this chapter of my book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker. If you're interested in ordering a copy of the book in its printed form, visit Amazon.com or my website at davidmaester.com/store.